Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 68 of Underserved. Today, we are featuring Kevin Jarno, CIO at Uptime Institute. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Thank you, Kevin, for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Way back when, what got you interested in technology when you were a kid?
Video games. So very early video games. I'm in my mid-50s, so you're thinking way back to the days of Pong and Tank Battle and when you had a unit that only played one game hooked up to your television through an RF frequency modulator. But yeah, I was just fascinated by the fact that you had these games that where you moved a joystick and something happened on the screen. And I wanted to know what was going on behind the scenes with those. And there was a few times where my father had to stop me from taking things apart. I would have my little Battlestar Galactica video game and I had the back open and I was prodding at it with a screwdriver, trying to figure out what is this thing doing? And sometimes the magical smoke would come out of the unit too. So I went through quite a few electronic games when I was a kid.
Yeah, I remember the Ground Round. They would have like an arcade game or something for a quarter. And it was mesmerizing to me. And I wanted to know how it worked.
Yeah, peanut shells on the floor and games in the back room. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. So what was your dad doing for work then?
So my dad was a civil engineer. He worked for the New York State Department of Transportation. He liked to think that he was more of a technical person, though I think he was better with concrete than he was with integrated circuits. I remember back in the early 80s, he decided, I want to learn how to use computers. And he went to a local computer store, and they were selling Apple II clones. And my father just came home with one of these things. I mean, they were thousands of dollars, and we didn't have that much money, but he wanted a toy, so brought it home. He started taking classes at the local high school for how to do basic programming. And he sat there for hours writing very simple basic programs. 2 weeks later, he said, I hate this thing. Do you want it? And I said, sure, of course I want it. So that now went into my bedroom. He was not allowed to touch it anymore. I started to teach myself how to program.
So you're doing like basic on this Apple II clone?
AppleSoft basic, yeah. Yeah, so no programs that were too complex at first, but you know, it was at least printing my name over and over and again on the screen. Lots of go-to statements. And then started slowly teaching myself how to do video game programming. I mean, I bought some magazines and typed in the code and reverse engineered it and figured out what made it tick.
Was this like all the stuff with like sprites and figuring out if they're colliding?
Not even. There were no sprites. That was a Commodore 64, I think, was the first one, or a VIC-20. Now, this was just very simple stuff. Yeah, even moving something across the screen, you had to do your own collision detection between things, too.
Was it like ASCII characters?
I think I started off there and then figured out how to use graphics mode.
Okay.
Yeah, all four colors.
And then you got a little bit into the social aspect as well, right?
Yeah. So later on, I discovered these things called bulletin board systems, BBS. And I grew up in Buffalo, so I would go through local magazines, local flyers in computer stores to try to figure out where are these bulletin boards? What are the phone numbers? And there was a bulletin board network called WWIV. I think it stood for World War IV. I don't know where they came up with that.
They skipped one.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, you know, I want to do this myself. This is really cool. And the great thing about WWIV was that not only could people call you, but your computer in the middle of the night could call other computers in the network. So I now became part of this WWIV network that was worldwide. It was a very simple version of email and file transfers and whatnot. And a big part of it, too, was it was kind of a social thing, even that early in the mid-80s. So we had get-togethers in bars and restaurants, and you got to meet some very interesting people who were into computers and bulletin board systems, including some people who were doing it for less than legal uses. And there's a long story there that I'll go into if you really want to hear it.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so I was running this computer network, and mine was more technical focused than anything, but you would share files. You know, if you wanted the latest copy of Lotus 1-2-3, yeah, you log in, you can download it. It was probably 100K, and, you know, it took about 3 hours to download back then. People were also passing around information about how to hack phones. There were these two guys who started a computer bulletin board on our network, and I didn't really know them at all. And they weren't very technical. So they were constantly calling me to get some advice. You know, this isn't working. How do you get that fixed? Blah, blah, blah. And one day I'm sitting in my stats class in college and somebody comes in with a note saying, call your mother. I'm like, oh, no, what's going on with my mom? And I call her and she's crying that the Secret Service had just called her, that they wanted me to come in for questioning. I'm like, the Secret Service? I didn't threaten the president. What's going on? Right. Well, I found out that the Secret Service is also part of the Treasury Department, and they're responsible for investigating credit card fraud. Well, these two guys that were setting up this computer on our network were actually passing around stolen credit card numbers. And they saw how many times they called me and I called them. And mind you, it was them calling for advice on how to fix things. And it was also our computers calling each other. So they called me in to question me because they thought I was part of this scheme. And well, guess what? I mean, I had nothing to do with it. In fact, they were watching me sitting in the waiting room where one of the guys was sitting across from me. I never met him face to face, and I never even looked like I knew who he was. So they were actually watching to see my reaction. And ultimately, they let me go. And I remember the lead investigator said, son, you're a credit to your nation. I'm like, okay, I'll take that. I don't know what I did, but still, yeah.
Yeah, the credit card stuff was big for a while. People just slamming around these 16-digit numbers at an expiration date because that's all you needed to do catalog orders or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. They were using it to buy more and more computer equipment for themselves, which was the funny part. They had some hard drives, 50 meg hard drives even back then,
yeah,
being delivered to them, and they had agents dressed up as the delivery guys. So that's how they got caught.
Wow, that's really cloak and dagger.
Oh, yeah.
So for you young whippersnappers, before the internet had everyone instantly and constantly connected, there was like a store and forward. So without folks like Kevin participating and allowing his computer to swap information with other computers at night, that email or file about hacking or phishing information wouldn't move anywhere.
Exactly. In fact, early Unix systems were passing around email through UUCP, which is Unix to Unix copy. That was before everybody was on the real internet. You know, it was all computers calling each other.
Trivia fact, you mentioned Lotus 1-2-3. The code name for the project that ultimately made Excel at Microsoft was Project Buddha because they wanted to assume the Lotus position in the marketplace.
Okay, nice.
So you mentioned you were at college. You went to, is it pronounced Canisius?
Canisius College, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
What was Canisius like?
Nobody told me that I could actually go away to college, so I stayed in Buffalo. And Canisius, along with SUNY Buffalo, had the two best computer science departments. So I decided to go with Canisius because it was a smaller school. I really wanted to understand everything about computers. I wanted to know how to program them. I wanted to know how to build them. I finally gave up on the building side and focused more on the programming side. So Canisius was the best place to go locally as a computer student.
And what sort of development are you doing as part of the CS program?
We started off with Turbo Pascal. I actually had a copy of Turbo C for myself, which I taught myself at night. But the great thing about their computer science program, it also taught things like object-oriented programming before that became a big thing. So we were using Modula 2. We were learning how to do real-time programming. So we did some stuff with Ada. And the most amazing things about this department was that they taught us graduate-level stuff without us even realizing it was graduate-level stuff. So not only were we learning how to program, but we were doing theory of computation, we were doing analysis of algorithms, we were doing some of the classes that, you know, later on when I actually did go to grad school, it's like, oh yeah, I did this already. I know how to do this stuff. So it was a good combination, a good mix. And I think our class started off with maybe 200 students and it was down to 20 by the time we got to senior year. It was a very small graduating class.
Wow, like a 10% graduation rate?
Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a rough washout.
Yes, it is.
Were there any great instructors or mentors that you met there?
There were, yeah. So along the way, I luckily met the head of the department at the time, Don Girard, who used to challenge me with little things to do that would never even think about doing unless he had actually brought it up. So he was constantly challenging me to figure out some pretty complex puzzles about how to do stuff on computers back then. And then there was another professor, Jeff McConnell, who is, I think, still currently the head of the department over there. So he's been there for quite some time. And he's the one who mentored me in lots of ways for theory of computation, especially in some of the more complex classes.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, you mentioned you wanted to be a rock star. What were you doing in bands back then?
Yeah, so I started at Canisius in computer science in 84, and then left the school for a little while, and I actually went to SUNY Buffalo after that as a music major, and I was playing in a rock band. So I was a keyboardist in a, I guess you can call it a new wave band, playing in bars around Buffalo. I was like the only guy I saw playing out back then who had stacks of keyboards hooked up to a computer. Part of it was just flash. It was just to have a cool computer screen up on top of my keyboard stack. But it also did. I mean, I actually used it to sequence some of the songs and play stuff behind the scenes. I did that for a couple of years. And actually, we opened up for bands like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, OMD. I'm actually going to go see them in a few months, which is going to be kind of cool for the first time in 35 years or something like that. Opened up for the Bodines, opened up for, and actually Run DMC. So when Run DMC had that huge hit back in 86 with...
Walk This Way.
Walk This Way, yeah, with Aerosmith. That was the tour. So here's this new wave band opening up in front of 2,000 rappers, rap fans, and we're playing Martha and the Muffins and the Pretenders and Howard Jones and music like that, and they're...
How'd that go over?
A little restless. So, I don't think anybody actually booed us off the stage, but they didn't quite take my guitar solo as seriously as I took it. So, yeah.
What was the name of your band?
It was Facade.
Facade.
Facade. Yeah. So I remember one time I was driving home and they were announcing bands that were playing ladies' night at this club we used to play all the time. And I hear them say, and this Tuesday at 8 p.m. is Facade. Like, okay, I guess we need to change the name of the band. Nobody can pronounce the Cedilla under the sea, but whatever.
Well, if that were true, I would have to rename the company from Syrinx because no one remembers how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
So when you graduate from there, what is your first job in the industry?
Actually, my first job in the industry was at Canisius. So I went back to Canisius, finished my CS degree. While I was still finishing my last class, compiler construction, making my own compiler, I went to work with a bunch of other friends from Canisius at a company called Frontier Science and Technology Research Foundation, FISTRF for short. And FISTRF was doing very early clinical trials work with AIDS and cancer research, which was kind of cool. At first, I was building data entry screens for all the clinical trials that were taking place for some of the drugs. I ultimately moved on to doing customer support. Got a bit of a personality, you know, so they said, well, why don't we send you off on the road? You can do training and tech support for all these clinics across the country. I got to go fly around and hang out with nurses all day. So for a 23-year-old, that was a pretty good gig. It wasn't exactly the greatest place to go, AIDS or a cancer lab, but still, you know, it was interesting work. Got to do lots of interesting things and meet some interesting people before actually going in and becoming a real programmer, I guess you could say.
Now, to move on from there, weren't you like one of the first people in the world to put your resume on the internet?
I may have been, yeah. So it was 1991, and I was about to lose my job. And I put my resume out on Usenet. For those of you who are younger than 40, Usenet were the news groups that everybody used to communicate. So it was take a bulletin board, put it on steroids, pre-web, and that's what Usenet was. And sure enough, about 2 days go by after posting my resume, and one of the programmers at a computational linguistics research lab at the University of Pennsylvania picks it up and says, you're exactly what we're looking for. And I had one phone call, scheduled the interview, left Buffalo at 4:30 in the morning, arrived in Philadelphia, had the interview, was offered the job on the spot, drove home and started packing. Yeah. And I started the next week.
That's a good gig.
It was a great gig.
Did you get to like a free Ivy League education out of it?
Go figure. Yeah, it worked out pretty nice. So not only was I getting paid, I finally had a chance to move on out of upstate New York and go elsewhere, but I had a free Ivy League education.
So after you spend a few years there, what do you decide to do next?
Yeah, so at that point was dating one of my coworkers who later became my wife. She actually lost her funding for her position and she landed a job at Houghton Mifflin here in Boston. And I said, okay, I like Boston. I'll go with you. So packed everything up, drove to Boston without a job and spent about a week looking for a job and then found one fairly quickly with a company called Investment Dealers Digest. So IDD was a publishing company, had been around since the 1930s. They had a series of financial publications in New York and their IT team was in Waltham. So I went to work in their IT team building software for stock databases. We specialized in intraday pricing databases. So you could see how a stock performed throughout the day, not just what was the closing and the opening price. And that was our big bread and butter. That was probably the best job I've ever had, and the smartest people I've ever met worked at that company.
Now, you had kind of a formative moment there when you decided to make an HTML version of what they were publishing?
Yeah. So when I was at Penn, I was constantly messing around. I'm surprised they didn't fire me because I was always playing around with some other technologies. And when I was at Penn, there was something called Archie. And Archie was like the very first hyperlinky search thing that you could do on the internet. It didn't work great, but it worked. And I knew a little bit about markup because when I was at Penn, we did a lot of work with SGML. So when I saw that there was this new World Wide Web thing, I said, hey, I know how this markup stuff works. I can tag things. And I taught myself HTML. So IDD was actually branching a little bit more into the consumer market. And we had a flyer that would be inserted into the newspaper. And it was something called Nest Egg. And Nest Egg was a insert in newspapers in the highest income zip codes in the U.S. I got a hold of one of the issues of it, and I actually said, hey, you know, I'm going to mark this thing up and see if I can actually come up with a web version of it. So I had a copy of Mosaic running on my Spark station at the time, and I set up whatever the simple web server was back then, nothing. And sure enough, I had a version of Nest Egg that you could actually interact with. And one day, chairman of the company came by and he had heard that I had made an electronic version of this Nest Egg publication. And he was blown away. He had never seen anything like that before. So the two of us worked on it together and it became a product. We actually had nestegg.itis.com was the name of the site. And that was back in the days when new websites came out. Yahoo would list the new websites of the day on Yahoo. There were days when you're like, oh my God, there's 20 new websites today. This is amazing, right?
Exponential growth.
Yeah, it's like, this thing's out of control. I remember just jumping up and screaming when I saw that Nest Egg was listed on there. And we were actually one of the very first financial websites on the web.
Now, do they monetize that? Like, what do they end up doing with it?
I think it was just a short-term experiment. It was around for a little while. And if you go to the Wayback Machine on archive.org, you can still find copies of it. But it was mostly just advertising. Over time, IDD, the magazine portion, was bought by Source Media and they shut everything down. All the software we were building was purchased by some other companies. So you know, that company's gone now, but you can still find remnants of it on the Internet Archive, which is kind of fun to look at.
Now, is IDD where you first moved into management?
It is, yeah. So programming was my thing. I remember getting into the flow and you know listening to Tangerine Dream on my headphones and looking up. It's like, oh, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, right? So it was definitely something that was really something I loved doing. But it always bugged me that I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. I didn't know why I was doing something. I knew what I had to do. I was told what to do. So I wanted to start to get more involved with the strategic side of the business. And the only way to really do that was to get into the management. I had a great mentor, John Bartel. John, I hope you're listening, who was my manager, my director. And he's the one who gave me my first opportunity to become a manager. So at the time, IDD, I guess riding on my coattails for making Nest Egg, we got into the web business. And we actually created the first version of the Wall Street Journal's website. We created the first version of Barron's Online. Some of the big financial publications on the web came from IDD. And he gave me a team that was responsible for building some of the tools for providing information through these websites. So, you know, being able to publish stock charts and whatnot, right? So my team was responsible for developing all that software. Thankfully, he gave me a crack team of developers too. A lot of entrepreneurial developers, very smart people worked on my team and in that company.
Now, this is the late 90s, so you must be tempted to go to a dot-com.
So I was at IDD from 93 to 97 and went to work for Jim Manzi at a company called Nets Inc. Now, for those of you who remember Lotus Corporation, made Lotus 1-2-3, it was started by a gentleman named Mitch Kaper, who was one of the saints of software in the Boston area, especially. Well, his second in command was Jim Manzi. Jim took over when Mitch retired, and Jim was responsible for taking Lotus away from the desktop and moving more on the network. And he was the person responsible for championing Lotus Notes, which we all know was the predecessor to just about everything that we're doing now, business-wise, especially with Office 365. And so when I found out that Jim was creating this company called Nets Inc., they brought together large companies who wanted to sell things on the web and bringing them together into a large marketplace. I thought that was an incredible idea. The commercial side of doing web work, didn't spend too much time doing that. I really wanted to investigate it. So I went to work at Nets as one of their managers. And about 2 months later, the whole company got shut down. It was traumatic because I quit a job that I loved at IDD and went to work for this company that I thought was going to be like the big thing. And I'm like looking for a job. A couple days after we were laid off, I received a phone call saying, hey, the CTO for Nets is trying to actually find a buyer for the entire senior leadership team of the technology side to continue building these marketplaces. And I was told, just sit still, don't do anything, don't worry, it's all going to work out. And behind the scenes, Mark Teflon, his name was chopping around, trying to find a buyer for 30 people who were the senior technologists for this company.
So it's like a Hail Mary acqui-hire?
Exactly. And he pulled it off. It was kind of like watching a Bills game, right? He threw the Hail Mary, and Ross Perot, as some of you people may remember, ran for president, and his company, Perot Systems, was looking for something like that. They wanted to get out of the old blue blazer, tan pants sort of consulting work and get into the whole dot-com thing. And this was the perfect opportunity for him to pick up an entire team that knew what they were doing, supposedly, to start building these massive marketplaces. So we got together after the acquisition. Mort Meyerson, who was the president of the company at the time, met with us and he said, hey, we don't know what we're going to do yet. We're going to start paying you now. Everybody just hang on and we'll tell you when we're ready to actually start doing something. So I bought a house like a month before I was laid off from NetSync.
Oh.
Yeah, my first house. I was a smoker at the time. I was chain smoking on my back deck, watching my grass grow, waiting for that phone call, but I'm getting paid, right? So it's like, okay, all right. I actually got paid the entire summer to do nothing but chain smoke and watch my grass grow. My grass came out great. And then they told us that we created this new division called Time Zero. And Time Zero was taking the idea of building these marketplaces, but doing it at scale. Lots of cash being sent into this. So great office space in Kendall Square. We got the company from 30 to roughly 300 over a period of about 2 years. Hmm. I mean, we really grew this company. We created something called Order Zone, which was companies like W.W. Grainger and some other large players in the commercial real estate supply world. If you're a building manager and you need light bulbs, smocks, stepladders, and kerosene, you know, you could go to one place to be able to buy everything that you need.
I'd love to see that project.
Yeah. This is 1997, 98, and the technology was cool back then, but it was actually, looking back, it was like the Stone Age for a lot of this technology. But we created these massively distributed systems to handle the load, and it was just a fascinating company to work for.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first.
You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So how does the acquisition with Perot go? Is it digested or did they reject the organ or?
Well, we lasted from 97 through 99. Ross used to call us the weirdos in Cambridge, which we took with pride. We did not wear blazers. We wore t-shirts and jeans. And we did some great work there. But ultimately, Ross decided he was going to step down from the company. His son, Ross Jr., took over. And Ross decided we were not core to the business. So got the word that we were laid off. At that point, I've been laid off a few times in my career. It's like, okay, here we go again, right?
We get my layoff boots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think this is an important thing about being in the tech field is that assume you're going to get laid off or you're not going to stay with the job for a long time, but that the next thing you're going to find is going to be better than what you had. And as long as you're preparing yourself to be able to step up, learn more, take on more responsibility, and move up that ladder, this is how you propel yourself up into the C-suite. So when I started at Perot Systems, I was an architect, then I became a director of engineering, and then I went on to start my own company with two friends and became a CTO. I could have picked any title. CTO just seemed to be the most likely one. And once you have that title, you've established that next foothold up the mountain.
This is the new floor.
Exactly. Exactly. I can go down, but I don't want to go down. I'll stay at this level. Thank you very much. We started a company called BDX, which is short for Business Data Exchange. And the idea was that there was a new SEC regulation called Regulation Full Disclosure. A lot of people were investing in the stock market who did not have access to earnings calls. Earnings calls were private calls over regular phone lines into conference rooms where you had to be an analyst, you had to be somebody in the industry to actually listen in. And then after the fact, they would publish some of the information, but it wasn't the same thing. So Reg FD said, nope, if you're going to be having a quarterly or annual earnings call, you need to make this available for everybody to listen in on. So they started doing a lot of audio streaming. The problem is now you're doing audio streaming and you can only listen to one thing at one time. You can't listen to two earnings calls at the same time. So we decided we were going to figure out how to take these live audio streams and convert it to text in real time and stream it down to somebody's desktop. And as the text is being streamed down to them, we're highlighting important key sections. If there's discussion about management changes or actual numbers and dollar amounts and estimates and projections, we flag that in real time and it's highlighted.
So this is humans actually curating this?
Yeah. So we tried text-to-speech at first. It was, you know, Siri's bad enough as it is right now in 2022. You know, it was getting everything wrong. So we started looking around for ways to do that, which is court reporters, the closed captioners who are working for lots of companies that do this sort of work. And these people had downtime. So we were actually paying them on their downtime to listen in on these calls, key it in. And then I created the software that beamed it in real time, right, what they're typing to our centralized server. And as it was coming in, find the key sections and highlight it, actually marked everything up in XML and stored everything in a database for later access. And it worked. It was great.
So you make it work. Does someone come along and write you a check?
Yeah. So that's the hard part, right? So here we are. There were three of us full-time and a bunch of part-time people working on this project. Ultimately, we decided it's time to find a buyer for this. Self-funded. It was at the end of the dot-com days. The funny thing is that we had some huge customers. Merrill Lynch, I think, was one of our customers. Cantor Fitzgerald. I think Goldman was actually a customer too. But what they didn't realize was that this entire system that they were using was hosted on an old computer in my basement running Linux over my cable modem. And I had a two-year-old. Hi, Tommy. I hope you're listening. He was now 23. And Tommy was fascinated by the power light on the computer. So every once in a while, I would get a phone call from our CEO saying the site is down. And sure enough, Tommy had been downstairs in the basement and pressed the power button, turned everything off. So yeah, we moved to Rackspace at that point. So we decided it was time to move on. We were looking for a buyer and CCBN had a product called Street Events. And Street Events was very close to what we were doing. And they were thinking about doing something related to Reg FD. It was just a perfect match. So CCBN was actually a division of Thomson Reuters. So I like to say we sold the company to Thomson Reuters.
Now, you had kind of a funny phrase. You said you swapped jobs with a friend in order to get your next job.
Yeah. So here I spent the last 2 years of my life in a really early stage startup. I had a friend, Paul Weitz. Hi, Paul. Who was the VP of technology at a company called the Debt Exchange, DebtX. And Paul was thinking about starting his own startup. I wanted a real job because I needed to get paid to actually do stuff. And we decided to swap careers, swap lives for the most part. Yeah. So he stepped down as VP. I came in as VP of technology. He went on to start a security startup, which I think was around for a few years. Went to work at DebtX as employee number 10. And basically what DebtX did was they came up with this great idea of working with financial institutions who had commercial real estate loans. And back in the old days, if you were a bank and you issued a multi-million dollar commercial real estate loan and the person who borrowed the money or the company that borrowed the money couldn't make their payments, after a while you would say, okay, we got to try to make our money back. And you would sometimes sell these loans to somebody else for cents on the dollar, 20 cents on the dollar. And that was called a loan workout. So the idea behind DebtX was instead of doing it that way, let's have a marketplace. We're creating a secondary market for commercial real estate debt. And so we had to create an auction engine. Each of these commercial real estate loans had thousands of documents associated with it. So we needed a document management system so that if you were an attorney working for a potential buyer, you had access to all the documents. We needed to build a trading desk for the internal traders who are actually trying to help sell these loans. So we built all this stuff from scratch, and it turned out to be wildly successful. And I think at the peak, we were up over 120 employees. And ultimately, my engineering team grew to be somewhere in the 20 to 30s, and we would bring in outside consultants to work with us. Put together an amazing team of engineers working there, product people, and we started working with larger institutions worldwide selling loans. Got to the point where we were selling hundreds of millions of dollars worth of commercial real estate loans in a yearly basis. And then along comes 2008, the whole economy starts going south, and the FDIC is closing down banks left and right. So these banks are holding commercial real estate loans. FDIC doesn't want them, so they want to sell them. Well, guess who they're going to use? So they actually contacted us to start auctioning off these commercial real estate loans for them. And suddenly we were making money hand over fist. It was amazing. Bosses on CNBC every other day. And, you know, it was, oh, there's Kingsley again. We thought it was going to last a while until the FDIC decided that they weren't going to stop doing that because they ran out of money. So it was a huge blip that brought us upwards. And then we came back down again a little bit and then leveled out. But we started doing more international work. And at some point, we actually had to rebuild our infrastructure. So I was there for 15 years, which is unheard of for a technologist. And I had never been at a company long enough where you build the software and then have to rebuild the software. So we actually went from the older ASP Microsoft stack to ASP.NET and started bringing in some newer technologies at that time. Then we started branching out into doing things like mark-to-market pricing. So there was a new regulation that organizations needed to have regular mark-to-market pricing to determine how much their loan portfolios were worth. So we built the software to do that too. We were suddenly pricing trillions of dollars worth of loans on a monthly basis. So we built out a whole data analytics side, data science side of the organization too.
Well, the data analytics and data science ends up coming in handy in your next role, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was at DebtX for over 15 years. And then, hey, it's time to do a startup again. Started poking around on the web, went on some interviews. And then ultimately, I got a very strange request to meet from a company in Cambridge. And it was strange only because they were using the software. It was kind of an AI software to schedule the meetings. And I could never quite get this thing to respond to me correctly. But ultimately, I realized it was a real person on the other side behind the AI and went to work for a company called Micronauts. Micronauts was started by two MIT grads who had some success in other companies, and they came up with this idea to use machine learning to help financial institutions, mostly credit unions and banks, to help better understand their customer base using machine learning to find groupings. You have a problem where these banks, nobody's going into the bank branches anymore. Yeah, you would go maybe once or twice a year. Generally, you're using an ATM or you're on the phone or using an app. So back in the old days, if you went into a bank, there was multiple opportunities for the bank employees to be able to talk to you about your needs. Oh, your son is 17 and you may need a school loan. Do you need a new mortgage? Do you want to refinance a mortgage? Do you want to do whatever? Because nobody's going into the branch, the banks have no idea what their customers need anymore. And so they're all they're doing all the time when you go onto their website is not even targeted. They're just kind of like throwing out advertisements at you. But nobody's going into the branch. Let's figure out a way to help the banks better understand their customers and be able to really have solid leads on how to upsell and cross-sell their current customer base. So what we would do is we would get a feed of all the information about a bank's customers, and we knew what they had done, you know, what their balances are. We knew what types of loans they had, what types of services they were using through the bank. And we would find groupings within the bank. Okay, this person kind of looks like that person. This person just refinanced their car. Maybe that person wants to refinance their car that looks like them, right? You're using machine learning to do so. And what we would do is use that data to embed a little questionnaire within their online or mobile banking session to be able to say, hey, it looks like you might be in the market for refinancing your car or financing a car or refinancing your mortgage. And then if yes, we can take them down a series of questions and generate a hot lead back to the bank to say, call this person now. They just told us they want a mortgage. So we worked on that for a couple of years, went from just a handful of banks and credit unions to over 100 by the time I left there. And it was a truly fascinating, enjoyable experience. Great coworkers and some interesting technology.
Now, you had met a bunch of folks from 451 Advisors. How are they involved in the next step in your career?
Yeah, so let's think way back to when I was working at IDD. I made some good friends there, and I met some very smart people. And I kept in touch with him over the years. Yeah, we would go out, have drinks every once in a while. We'd at least catch up, you know, networking. It's so important to network as part of your career. I repeat that over and over again for everybody listening. It's worth it. It's worthwhile. So I had kept in touch with some of these people over the years. And actually, 451 Group was a kind of a competitor for Gartner Group. They acquired the Yankee Group years before. They were doing a lot of work as analysts and doing all kinds of other stuff, too.
So they were analysts and publishing reports and thought leaders.
Yeah. So it was much like Gartner and Forrester. They would generate reports about certain sectors, different products, different sectors of the economy. My friend Kieran, he was the CIO for 451 Group. Martin McCarthy, who was the CEO at IDD. Chris Hill and a bunch of other people that I worked with back then at IDD all stuck together over the years on and off and were working together at the 451 Group. And, you know, there were a few times where I actually went in and we were entertaining the idea of me coming on as CTO or something like that. Never happened, but I still stayed in touch. And one day I reached out to Kieran and he said, hey, you know, we actually just sold the majority of the company to S&P. So what used to be the 451 Group Advisors is now the S&P Group Advisors. And they're retaining one small part of 451, which is this company called Uptime Institute. And they didn't have anybody in a senior leadership role on the technology side because the CIO for Uptime went off to Business Advisor and they needed somebody to put together a three-year plan. Nobody had really been thinking about it for a while. So I came on as a consultant, worked there for a while, put together a pretty detailed three-year plan for them, and ultimately was offered the role of CIO at the company. And it's kind of a misnomer because when you think CIO, you're mostly thinking back office stuff and whatnot. This is a combination of CIO and CTO. So I came on as CIO last October. And right now we just went through a phase where we brought in a new partner and we have a cash infusion. So now we're starting to grow the company again, which is an incredibly fascinating thing to do.
Private equity injection.
Exactly. So Uptime, their reason for existence is data centers. There's a tier certification that most data centers go through, tiers 1 through 4, about how well you can handle downtime and how well your electrical systems are set up and all these different things.
How many nines you have.
Exactly. And that tier certification comes from Uptime Institute. And Uptime is also a thought leader in the data center industry. We do education, we do training, we do everything related to data centers. And you would think that this is something that is going away because everybody's moving to the cloud. Well, the cloud is all data centers. So our customers are now companies like Microsoft and Meta and Google and you know, but it's also companies like Walmart. Walmart's got one of the largest computer networks in the world. Lots and lots of work across the world. And we're actually doing work in every region of the world these days. In fact, more in areas like Saudi Arabia and whatnot than we are in the US, but that's even starting to go back up again. I've been with Uptime now since October as CIO, starting to put together new infrastructure, some new products, lots of greenfield development, which is, you know, for all you computer geeks, you know how much fun it is starting from scratch with something. So lots of interesting things to look forward to over the next few years.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, when you're away from keyboard, I know you do a little traveling, and I saw on LinkedIn that you were involved with the Boy Scouts and some fundraising for JDRF.
Do you want to talk
about any of those?
Sure, yeah. So for years, my son was a Cub Scout and then a Boy Scout, so I was a Scout leader. I was a Scout when I was a kid until I was kicked out for kind of beating up the Scout leader's son, but we don't talk about that. So I'm kind of making up for my childhood.
There's an NDA surrounding this settlement.
Yeah. So I spent a good 5 or 6 years as a scout leader. And the funny thing is that a lot of the things I had to teach my scouts, I didn't know before I read about it in a book on the train ride home from work before I had the scout meeting. So there was a lot of just-in-time training with my scouts, but they did win all kinds of different competitions, which is great. And then for a few years, I took part in triathlons to raise money for juvenile diabetes, which was incredibly important. Being able to do something like that was something I never thought I could do as an asthmatic computer geek as a kid. So spent years doing that. Now I'm spending lots of time trying to get my pandemic weight to go away.
Amen.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Kevin, thank you so much for coming down and sharing with the listeners of Underserved your stories and experiences.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.